And welcome once again. It's your girl Cheryl and the Old School News Crew. We're here back at you with all kinds of discussions on the hottest topics of the day. And just so you know, if you ever want to join us, you all you have to do is email me at yourgirlcheryl@gmail.com. And we'll talk about the best time for you to call in or whatever topic you want to talk about. But I got to thank and welcome my Old School News Crew here one more time. I want to welcome, we're going to start off with Winston Thomas because I always usually do him last. So Winston Thomas, welcome.
Hey, top of the morning, afternoon, evening, everybody.
Okay, that covers it whenever people are listening. We want to thank and welcome Sheila Gaskins.
Hey, what's up, people?
And we want to thank and welcome Mike Easterling.
Hey, everybody, anybody got a bonnet on today? Any
bonnets? let's not go back to the bonnets, okay?
No bonnets, okay.
Bonnie.
Now, I'm glad we had that discussion, though. You know, that was a good one.
And that was a good one.
Yeah. So talking about the Black women wearing bonnets out in public. And if we have a lull today, we'll go back to it. But I don't think so. We've got a lot to talk about, as always. And I'm sorry, I got to talk about this because, you know, this week, you know, I like Rachel Maddow a lot. Okay. So I'll watch her. And she came on and she was prefacing her show with how what she was going to talk about. That there was breaking news, that it was wiping out what she had planned to talk about. This was so important. This was the biggest thing. She had never heard of this before. And it had to do with finding out that during the Trump administration, the Department of Justice had been gathering information about reporters and trying to find out who was leaking under the guise of leaking, who was leaking information from the Trump administration. So they were investigating all these people without cause. You know, it's not like they were convicted. It was thought that they were committing a crime and then there was an investigation. It was just, it seems as if Trump was just saying, I don't like this one. So go after them, go find out. And in some cases they were even investigating their children. You know, so this is like a horrendous turn of events or information to find out that the Justice Department would be doing this. But at the same time, every time I hear the Democrats talk about it, everybody is outraged by this behavior that this has happened. But it just seems like one more thing that, you know, Republicans are being accused of or Trump is being accused of. And, you know, the question remains, is he ever going to jail? Is he ever getting arrested? Why is it we just keep hearing about more and more damaging, I can't even say damaging, more and more transgressions, but nothing seems to happen. Is anything ever going to happen, you think?
I think so, but as time goes on, I'm starting to feel like these guys are all in one big club. You know, they see this as a game. They're not really trying to permanently damage or you know, knock each other off. It's the political game they're playing, you know, and I get that feeling because if you ever see them at events together, I mean, they're totally friendly. Ha ha, he, you know, but in the media, you know, everybody's up against McConnell. They hate McConnell and McConnell hates Biden. Them guys get together. They're like old chums. They golf together. All of this is not a big deal. So this is all a game to them. And I don't think they're really going hard after each other. You know, you ever notice the biggest thing they talk about when one of them gets caught up in something is, we demand he resign. And I'm sitting here like, resign? Where are the handcuffs? You know, but they use resignation like that's some big punishment. You know, oh, I got to quit. You know, it's ridiculous.
It's all ridiculous. I saw Stacey Abrams, right, on Z-Way, which is an excellent show. Anyway, she was talking about how it's the Republicans versus America. And so having that mindset is comfortable for them. Like they want to be in power so much that the Democrats are just going to close their eyes to what's happening because white males want to remain in power. And so if that's the case, you ain't going to really do nothing to your home person. Not really, because if you go down, if they go down, that means you can go down. So again, this is about holding on to the status quo. And I'm like bored. Like, it's so full of it, all of it.
You said bored? Is that what you said? Bored.
Yeah, this is it's all phony. It's all phony.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, years ago, you know, I've told you before, you know, I'm a Star Trek fan, but I'm also was a fan of the X-Files. And over the years, what sort of came out was, because the premise of that show was that this guy had witnessed an alien abduction. So he was always trying to prove that aliens existed. But what sort of came out near the end of the show was that the aliens were always in cahoots with a group of older white men, politicians in the country, and that they had developed an alliance, okay? And the aliens had helped them be in power, and you know, and how they were working together so that the aliens could do this or the white guys could do that. And, you know, not that I think that aliens are controlling the GOP, but I do think there's all a big plan. Sort of like you said, Winston, I don't know if it's that they're all trying to stay together, you know, work together, but I think it's a set plan, you know, and no matter what happens, it just seems that, like I said, if Michael Flynn can be accused of all these things, even admit he's lying to Congress, and then still get pardoned and he walks out of there, you know, all these people, they're just walking. Nobody is in, the only older white man I see who has, you know, atoned for anything with Bernie Madoff. They walked him out of there in handcuffs. That's what I want to see, you know? I mean, not just for GP, but because you're telling me A, B, C, and D did E, D, F, and G. So now's the time for somebody to get arrested or something. But we just keep talking about it. They testify to Congress. They write a report on this or that. But I don't see any accountability. And I don't even know how you force that. How we
see some accountability, just let Maxine Waters or Cedric Richmond, okay, or even Uncle Tim Scott get out of line. And then you'll see accountability. All right, they're honorary club. But until then, no, not the tight circle of people. I was like, look at sports. Certain coaches, smaller school coaches, Division I, lower, they mess up, they're fired, their careers are gone, they're back coaching high school. Big time guys, oh, tisk, tisk, and then quietly they're back on somebody's staff. And oh my gosh, they're back coaching ball again. Because the rules are just for us. There's a certain group of people that the rules don't apply to. And they know it. They know it.
And in saying that,
inner circle of some sort.
This might be taking it left a little bit, but I just remembered. Did anybody else see this week where that journalist, Jeffrey Toobin, is that his name, Winston? Because we talked about that.
Toobin.
Right. Yes. The guy who was caught masturbating on a Zoom call with his colleagues. Okay. Now I thought he got fired from MSNBC.
From one of his entities, places he worked, he got fired.
Right. Okay. Now here he is back after 7 months. And I think they gave him his show back. You know, I thought he was just on TV doing an interview to talk about, you know, how difficult these last 7 months have been, but he actually, I think, got his show back. Yeah. Now, are you telling me that this man, and is it because he's an older white man, there's no accountability? He can literally masturbate in front of his colleagues and he's not going to be, again, it don't have to be handcuffs, but.
Well.
He didn't break a law.
I think part of that is the numbers, the networks, they're like, if your numbers are good, it doesn't matter why they're good. That's why they love Trump. People watch. They watch Trump's buffoonery day and night. They love it. So they made crazy money when Trump was in office.
So you think putting handcuffs on Trump and walking him out is going to stop that? That'll take
the bottom line down? Is that event will be like epic. But once he's gone, they need another circus attraction. But back to Toobin, I think it's totally interesting to the public to see this guy back on. You know, people are jeering, talking about him. So his numbers will be great for a while, you know, and people will eventually forget about this.
Yep.
No, I told you, Winston, I will never forget that. I didn't see it. I don't need to see it, but I draw the line right there. I'm sorry. And I know we're supposed to be a forgiving people, and okay, forgive, but that doesn't mean everything goes back to normal, you know?
He did more damage to himself than any of us. Can you imagine the embarrassment of that?
But that's the point. Is it more embarrassing to him if he gets his job back, his salary back, and everybody just says, oh, and laughs it off? I got that image in my mind forever. So really, who's coming out on the worst end of that?
But that's how white boys think. They think that kind of stuff is funny anyway. The farting, the penis, the, you know, all of that is for them.
Yeah, so, that's Animal Farm back from the sugar party. Right.
But an old man who got away with it. You know how many white boys are probably thinking, dang, did you see that? He got away with it, man. Yeah.
That's Animal House, Winston, not Animal Farm. That's a different.
Oh yeah, I read that. I knew it was one of them.
That's something different altogether.
It's been a while.
No, okay.
At least I didn't say Kafka's Metamorphosis.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure you took the reference right. That's okay. But you make a point, Sheila, with that.
Yeah, Sheila, your point is right on.
That is funny to them. Trust me, I've been around a bunch of white comedians and they think that kind of stuff is hilarious. Mm.
And it's funny because actually, you know, Winston and I went to school together and he had just mentioned to me about hanging out at this fraternity. It was a white school, primarily white school, and about him hanging out at one of these fraternities and some of the white guys who were on the football team and just some of the traditional things that they would do at their keggers, you know. You're right about that. So should I just give this up and don't expect to see any kind of real? It's just going to be, you know.
I tell you, just wait till somebody of color does something like that. Then you get what you want: handcuffs, beatings, defaming, talking bad, disparaging remarks.
But until then, don't expect it. But why is it though that when Al Franken, senator, pretended? He didn't even touch the woman. I think she was asleep. And again, he's a comedian. He did something like this in front of her chest or something. And they railed him out of there so fast.
Let me tell a story. They were clowning around, first of all. And he stood, you know how someone can be at a distance and you stand between them and the camera? Mm-hmm. He put his hand up so that it looked like it was on her rear end. He didn't even make contact with her.
Yeah, I knew he didn't. Yeah.
But the photo suggested that he did. And that was enough to pressure him into resigning.
But didn't that happen before he was a senator? Because he was a comedian.
Yes.
He was a comedian at the time anyway.
Here's the difference. And I've seen this. I saw it with Cuomo. And I saw it with that governor in Virginia who got caught doing blackface with the lieutenant governor. That whole deal. The lieutenant governor was on rape charges, someone accused him. Here's the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. When a scandal breaks out with the Republicans, they deny and lie. It's on you, the accuser, to prove your accusation. And it dies down. The Democrats, so high and mighty, as soon as someone hints at a scandal, oh, I resign. We demand he resigns. And they just give in to it. And that's what Al Franken did.
Well, you know what? Instead of saying, because I agree with you, but instead of saying that they give into it, I think the first point you made is more accurate, that Democrats always want to take the high road. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I'm with Michelle Obama. When they go low, you go high, all of that. But there's a limit. You know, there's a structure in there. And the one thing I do admire about Republicans, they stay on point. They believe in a certain thing as a group. And even if they don't, they dial into that with the group. They will stay with the group on that. Okay. So they're all going to, you know, support that guy in Virginia, no matter what. He could be wrong, but they'll support it. Like you said, they'll lie or do whatever. But the Democrats always want to take the high road and say, oh, well, that's not appropriate. And it may not be, but it's not, he doesn't have to resign because of that.
And here's the thing, Cheryl.
They're quick to do that instead of, I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was gonna say, here's the thing that makes it worse. Our laws are written to, there's a presumption of innocence until proven guilty in a court of law. the Democrats just evidently forget all about that, because even the hint of an accusation, in Democrats' minds, they will demand that their own colleagues resign just because someone says something. They don't even worry about proof. They're like, oh, somebody said that about you. You need to leave, you know? And that is insane.
Well, you know, but to answer, just like you had mentioned Cuomo, even though it hasn't been proven, what they're saying is that because the accusation has been made, his colleagues now can't work with him. The level of trust, you know, that it has affected his ability to do his job. So that's the reason they're asking for the resignation. They don't have to wait for a legal determination.
So what happened to that, right?
He's still there. I'm not saying that's true, but I'm just saying that's how they're coming at it.
Plus, you know, the Republicans know their base. They know that white people vote for them. The Democrats know that some white people and other races vote for them. So that's why, you know, that's why I think the Republicans can stay true to who they are, because it's like we have this white solidarity, and the Democrats need the other folk in order to stay in office. So so there's no, they ain't losing nothing. The Republicans ain't losing nothing every time. They already know what's up. So that's what I had to say.
So is there any way for Democrats to get that kind of solidarity? You think the Democrats are too diverse as a group to have that kind
of Democrats, you know, or the left. And it's funny, I'm like this creature that floats in between, okay? I see craziness on both sides of the coin. The Democrats are just emotional misfits, okay? That's what I call them. So, yeah, I don't know what to say about that. You know, it's okay to be for good and for people and all of those things, but it's, you know, responsibility is a real thing. I don't know. It's funny.
I think the Democrats' diversity works against them sometimes. I mean, it's a plus to have that kind of diversity in the party, to have all the different ideas and to make sure you're taking care of the rights of everybody and all that. But the same diversity gives everybody the feeling that they can do what they want and say what they want. So when it comes down to policy, they're not going to all go on one page. Everybody want to do what they want to do. Right. So you can't get, you know, you've got this guy doing the March of Poor People, the Poor People's March against Joe Manchin next week, I think it is, or something like that. You would think that that kind of situation might bring everybody together, you know?
No, nobody cares what poor people think. I'm just being honest.
Yep. Because they're not in that inner circle. There's every organization, there's an inner circle of untouchables. I don't care if it's Boy Scouts, baseball, the convent, the priesthood. And then there it goes out. The farther you are from the inner circle, this is like any society, the farther you are from the center of the power, the more vulnerable you are. And like Winston said, so people that are far from, not just poor people who have no real political clout, they may not be poor, but they got no political clout. Nobody thinks about them. That's why people fight to get close to the political power. Why people fight to get close to a person like Trump. I know he's a butthole, but you know what? When I'm near him, I'm more protected. Okay. If you live on a street in an Italian neighborhood, okay, you can be the guy who hangs out over Italian church over St. Mary's with Father Del Monaco, or Father, you can hang out with Father Del Monaco's cousin, Rico, who runs the block. All right. And I grew up in Brooklyn, okay. I saw these things, you know, the first thing that I lived there. The power went to Rico. Everybody knew Father. And I'm a Catholic, everybody knew Father, but Rico and his boys on the street standing out in front of the fruit stand with nice suits on and nice cars. Okay. Everybody wanted to be, because Rico's a power. Somebody beat you up. Nobody went to Father. They went to Rico. Get your cousin. I'm going to get my cousin on you. Nobody's going to go get Father. I'm going to go get Father. Let's go get president.
Yeah.
My freaking cousin on you. You see, my cousin's Rico. So even the little black kids wanted to know Rico, because he was close to the power. I wasn't a mafia. I wasn't Italian. I wasn't going to get but so close. But I knew his Rico, whatever. I'm making the name up, but it was some kind of Carlo. I hung with his little cousins because something happened to me, you can go get his cousin, wasn't gonna happen anymore. Same thing. You gotta be close to the center. If you're not, you're expendable. Even if you're a priest.
That's sad.
That a priest doesn't have as much power as a gangster, but that's, I didn't make, that's a lot. That was way before I arrived on the planet. That was right.
That's right.
But is it true that they don't have as much power or perceived power? You know, because
it's fear and love. Okay. I think priests have more people love the priests. Say a little small neighborhood. You got a priest in a little small church, like when I grew up, little pocket of Brooklyn I grew up in. People love the priest, but they fear the gangster. Yeah, they feel the gangster, and both of them can take care of them. But in a tight situation, don't be near the gangster. Don't be there in your power. Be closer to power than love.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but as quiet as it's kept, certain gangsters, they like to show up to put on a good show. They show up at church.
Yep.
And they donate quite heavily.
Quite heavily.
So quiet as it's kept. They're tight with the priest too.
Absolutely. Because when that boiler goes up, okay, you go, all right, who are they gonna go talk to? Carlo. Carlo get it taken care of. You know, mm-hmm. Carlo go down the street, talk to the guy who works on the board of department. Let him, we don't have the money right now. I'm gonna give you the money. And then Father, I'll get the money back from the church one way or another. And that just makes him even stronger than the priest.
You're painting a very depressing picture, Michael.
But the overall picture is this. There's always going to be a little core of people, okay, that are cooler, hipper, more untouchable than the people around the edges. You know, so people want to work toward, and so, you know, Al Franken maybe was around the edges, you know, because he was relatively new, okay? But there's always going to be that center people, hey, we're untouchable. And history has proven that for them. We have a guest.
Yeah, I wasn't going to do it just as I wanted us to finish up this topic, but we can go ahead and bring Constance into the conversation. Because like I said, you just depressed me with that final analogy.
What's it? Am I telling the truth?
Facts. These are the facts. These are the facts of life.
Our life goes.
You just getting depressed? All this new? Shucks.
Okay. All right. So anyway, like you said, we have a guest caller because we wanted to talk about, this was another topic. We were going to talk about it last week or the week before when they were celebrating or recognizing the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race situation. We're not calling it a race riot, right? We're calling it a race massacre, just straight up massacre, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And we were going to talk about it, but it got delayed. But then Sheila introduced us to Constance, who has a lot of really great opinions and information about reparations and about some of this stuff. So we said, well, let's have Constance come on in and call us. How you doing?
I'm good, Ms. Cheryl. How you doing?
I'm fabulous.
And what's up, Constance? What's up?
How are you?
I'm right. I'm well.
That's good. Cool. That's good.
So what I did, I hope everybody saw it, but last week when I thought we were going to talk about it, I sent everybody this map that I saw on Facebook, and it had listed all these other race massacres and attacks that have happened over the century. You know, that we don't, because even the Tulsa situation, I didn't find out about that until a couple of years ago, you know, and that was never taught in schools or in any school I went to, you know. And, you know, we have this whole movement right now of whether it's the GOP or white society, I don't know who it is, that's trying to erase actual history and trying not to let what needs to be known be known. And on some, and in some regard, it's on us to educate our own selves or find out, you know. So just in talking about that, because the reparations is a sort of a separate issue, but it comes into play with what happened in Tulsa. Let me put it as a question, first of all. I mean, were any of you, do any of you feel like you have more information as far as the, because once the Tulsa recognition came up, more people were saying, oh, you know, this is not the only time, this has happened many times. And were any of you, I mean, because we're all about the same age, Sheila is a little bit younger. So I don't know educationally if you were a little bit more informed than we were. Were most of you more informed that you knew that those kind of situations have been going.
I am younger, and Constance is even younger than me. I was familiar with Tulsa and all of those type of massacres. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that the how many existed.
Yeah. It's actually the one that Winston and I talk about a lot, because Winston's from Philadelphia, is a situation that happened with the Move folks, the movement, and how the city literally bombed their home, you know, and that one happened in my lifetime. And I would think, but you never hear about that. That should have been a movie of the week. You know what I'm saying? That should have been.
You know what, Cheryl? I kind of put that in a different category than, say, Tulsa. My understanding is, the situation in Tulsa, that purely, well, we heard the story the other night when we watched the documentary, but they claim that happened because of a supposed crime. A white woman said the black man touched her in the elevator and word spread. But they really were jealous of these black people doing well in that Black Wall Street community. And they wanted to go in and destroy that anyway. They use that one incident as an excuse to kick it off. Same thing in Philadelphia. The reason I want to put that in a different category, those people had refused to pay their rent. And when they tried to evict them, they found out that they had fortified all the doors and windows to a point where no one could get in. I don't know where bombs had to be called in. I don't recall any gunfire going back and forth. Even so, at what point in the middle of a city do you say drop a bomb on them?
But even given that, once you get to that point, and now here we are years later, the fact that we're arguing about reparations, regardless of whether it happened like it did with Move or whether it happened with Tulsa, aren't these people and their descendants, shouldn't they be? Aren't they eligible for reparations? I mean, if anybody would be, wouldn't these people be? I mean, Constance, is that the kind of work that you're doing? Are you?
Yeah, so basically how I see it and what happened to Tulsa and other Black towns is reparations is definitely due, but I see it being under the umbrella of reparations on a federal level, and those set aside instances will have more redress, because those like their towns and businesses, that's, you can prove that, you know, you are a descendant of the event that happened in Tulsa, and can prove that, you know, the businesses and the money that could have been had and passed down from generations, you know, you could have definitely lived a better lifestyle. So I see reparations, it is all under one umbrella when you talk about instances that happened on a state level.
Do you think, like, because one thing that through that whole Tulsa recognition thing from anniversary a couple of weeks ago, I mean, and even to see those who were survivors who are over 100 years old now, how they could even leave DC without somebody giving them a check, I don't get.
Giving them a check immediately.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's always got to be a head conversation and research when it comes to redressing our grievances. But when it comes to, you know, other communities, they have no problem with addressing their grievances. And so when I think about reparations as a community, that's something that I think our voices definitely have to be heard collectively when advocating for these injustices.
Okay, now you're depressing me along with Michael. He was depressing me this.
Look, if you want to get depressed, then we talked about this earlier.
And to speak about depression, to go 100 years and see injustice and live it for 100 years is it makes me depressed.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Winston. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I had mentioned this to you earlier, but I just found out this week that, are you guys aware that when slavery was abolished, the slave owners received reparations from the U.S. government because they lost.
I just not realize that. Yeah, I just thought
that. Yeah.
That's insane.
No, yeah, yes. So,
property back. Oh, go ahead, Michelle.
2015 in London, they just paid off all the slave owners in London in 2015 from the 1800s. And some people were abolitionists who had slaves in England. So, Constance.
So that's your comment on that.
Look, Constance, tell them how much we would get.
Okay. So, and so I followed Dr. Sandy Darity and his wife, A. Kirsten Mullen. They wrote this book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And they go around different universities, different places, speaking and advocating for reparations. And they propose at the minimum $11 trillion. And that pans out to be $850,000 per household. And that's at the minimum, that's just to get us started. That's what they're advocating for, you know? Yeah. And the biggest thing with reparations I'm finding in my advocacy is people not understanding the need for cash payment. Like land with no cash is how we get the results of our, when you look at our neighborhoods, the dilapidation, because people don't have the money to keep up. It's never been an instance in history where we had a problem gaining and doing business, participating in the housing market. We've done it all. The problem has always been sustaining it, you know? So when I tell people cash is definitely needed, cash is king. We living in a capitalist society. You can't just be like, well, I have this land. I mean, you can make profit off of it, but cash, reparations without cash payments is not a real reparations program. So yes, at the tune of $850,000, that's what we're advocating for. That's what we're fighting for. And I don't know, I mean, $850,000, and they don't have to be, it's been proposed that can be breaking up, you know what I'm saying? They kind of leave it open for negotiation, but that is at the bare minimum what we're looking at. And, that's a huge number. That means, your aunt, your cousin, their children, you know, that's a lot of money that we can do within the community.
Well, I don't want to be depressing, but here's what I understand about negotiations. Here's what happens in a negotiation. Two questions are asked. One, what happens if we don't do this? The answer to the reparations question is nothing. The other question is, what happens if we do this? And the question again, the answer comes back, nothing that we want to happen.
When you say do this, you're talking about
reparations? In regard to the 11 trillion. So in other words, if you imagine someone trying to, you know, decide if they're going to do this, what's the repercussions if we don't? If there are no serious repercussions to be suffered, you ain't getting it.
Right.
That's the bottom line. Right.
But if you do give it, there would be very positive repercussions.
No. Not that what you want. In regard to what Sheila said in the beginning, they're already upset because our population is starting to outnumber them. They don't want us to be economically strong.
Exactly.
They don't want that.
That is the fight. You know, and that's the problem. They haven't been wanting us to be considered human, but we fought against that notion. Our ancestors fought to get it. They've been fighting against every notion to be free and to exercise their civic duty in this country. So people going to think what they want to think. It's about what you're willing to fight for and advocate for. That's what I say.
And there's just no upside for them. There's no upside for them to do that.
Exactly.
It's actually an article that came out. It's a lot of upside for them to pay Black Americans reparations. It's an article that came out that said the United States is losing, they lost $16 trillion. I want to say in 2020, it might have been in 19. Don't quote me, but you can Google it. United States loses $16 trillion due to racial inequality. So reparations given to Black Americans can help their image on a international level, because they
lost money. Constance, where would that $16 trillion where would that have come from? The money that they lost, where would it have been coming from?
I guess in countries doing business with the United States. I'm gonna try to put it in the chat. You can read it for yourself, but just from the headline, they lost $16 trillion. I'm sorry.
Now, I remember hearing about that. I remember that figure. But you know what? But actually, the idea of the reparations is, yes, to make people whole or give them back what they lost or what they could have had. But the vision of that is supposed to be that if in fact you gave Black Americans this, it would improve their lives, which would then improve the lives of society, the life in society, which would improve, you know. So if you keep on going up, there is an upside. It's just they don't, that's not the upside they want. Correct. Even if the final result was that the world would be wonderful, it wouldn't be wonderful under white control. And that's, I think they want it to be wonderful, but they still want that caveat in there. So there is an upside. It's just not the upside that they want. So I guess you're right in that, Winston, that there's, you know, there's a negative on both sides of that.
So I watched a documentary on the FBI and Martin Luther King, and they was talking about how effective King was with the media, showing all of the dogs getting the kids and the hoses, and other countries was like, what? You gonna tell us, you think you this superpower, you gonna tell us how to act, and you treating Black people like that? So I can see how that racism can hurt the United States.
It's definitely hurting the economy.
But everybody was so they were like, they don't believe it. There's no belief in America. There's no, it's like bull crap.
It's almost like when you figure, you know, going back to Obama presidency, like internationally, they got overall like huge thumbs up for his presidency, and you compare it to Trump, you know, it's kind of that same, like how you view, like what you do as a country and who's your president, it matters internationally.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that now with the G7 summit that they're going through, and they keep showing film clips of when Trump was there and now that Biden's there. And it's, some of it is so ridiculous that, again, I'm surprised that we as a country just allowed, I mean, again, short of a recall on the Trump presidency, but that we would allow this man to represent this country, you know, from whether he's pushing other diplomats out the way, other leaders out of the way so he can be in front of the line, or he's walking in front of the Queen of England, you know, and I mean, just all kinds of little things. And those are just some of the visuals, you know, not to mention the decisions he was making that really put America in a lesser light, you know. So, and to your point, Sheila, they say that the civil rights movement changed after those images got on television, that it was the rest of the country seeing those people being hosed and dogs put on them. That's what made, you know, everything sort of shift, because that was the way of life in the South for, you know, for some time.
One of the things I say, we had talked about that months ago with Brooke, and I agree, but the Memphis from Montgomery, the incidents with the dogs and stuff that Sheila referred to, I see those things as causing white guilt with a good percentage of white America. The left, the actual Christians, the real Christians of white America, when they see those incidents, that's when guilt kicks in, and that's why we've enjoyed the progress that we have enjoyed thus far in this country. If it wasn't for that white guilt, I can't even imagine what we'd all, we wouldn't be on this Zoom right now, I guarantee you that. Okay.
White guilt, I take it. We're going to take it all the way to Congress and ride this thing to reparations.
That makes sense. Because I was just going to say, would you call it white guilt, the fact that white Americans participated so heavily in the George Floyd protests? You know, yes. I think was that guilt? I mean, did they feel guilt behind that? Or do you
think? Let me tell you something.
I think it's a reawakening to like the realization of like, we're living in a country where this is illegal, where it's legal, where people mm-hmm. are being treated this way. Like you say, like people just being educated and mm-hmm. actually seeing it and seeing that man beg for his life. If it didn't pull at your heartstrings, then you know you the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, well that's right. So I don't think that's guilt, Tom.
No. Here's where I said that, Cheryl. Right after the George Floyd thing, and I've been seeing this a lot anyway, but right after the George Floyd situation, I go to the grocery store up here in Towson. I'm in line. First of all, everybody's referring to me as sir. Hi, sir, how are you today? Come on in, sir. I got in line to pay for my groceries. Older white guys in front of me, he looks back. He said, you know what, buddy? Why don't you just go in front of me? Right. I had more stuff than he did. He said, nah, I'm not doing anything. I don't have anything to do. Why don't you just go ahead? And it's little things like that I'm seeing more and more and more. I'm telling you, there's a
consciousness. Education. I would say, I think being educated on what's going on maybe brought up something and it's just like, man, you probably really, really got it bad. We might need to start paying a little bit more attention. But if that guilt doesn't equate to you pushing and advocating alongside Black Americans for reparations, then keep it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know. I don't want to argue semantics. You know, I don't know if it's guilt or, and I think particularly in those kind of cases, Winston, I think those people, they want to make sure you differentiate between them and shaving. You know, I ain't that guy. Okay. Right. I might be a white guy, but I'm not the one putting the knee on the neck. Okay.
Right. Yeah. That's that individualism come out. Yeah.
I don't want to see you hang from a tree or be killed unjustly, but I also don't want to see you economically.
Make it, as my neighbor. Making more money than me.
How you get Tulsa, what happened in Tulsa, because, you know, people got jealous. Mm-hmm. The moment you start making more than them, then it's definitely a problem.
But that's the thing. So, it's not even making more than them. I had heard, and I mentioned this the other day, that I think it's like 25% white men, white heterosexual Christian men make up 25% of the community, but they are 85% in charge of the leadership of this country. Something like that. The figure was something
right.
And all of this backlash has happened because that 85% has gone down to 75%. So it's not that they don't want to see you equal, you know, they don't want to give you some, they just want to remain in power. They want to remain having all of it, you know, mm-hmm. so they're not even okay with it coming down so that, what you just said, Constance, they don't want to see us share in it. They want to mm-hmm. stay over top of it. And that's the part that, you know, takes me back to Chris Rock and the big piece of chicken. Who is you to get the big piece of chicken? Who is you to decide that you get to be in charge like that? We all out here together. You know,
especially when your ancestors built the country, you know, with their blood, sweat and tears, and then after that, been just discriminated and excluded from participating economically in mainstream America. Like our numbers is dire. We are headed towards economic genocide. 2053, an article states that Black Americans will be at zero wealth.
Oh, Jesus.
2053, and that's not a lot of time. So when you talking about reparations and closing that racial wealth gap is important, because 2053, that's grandkids, my great nieces and nephews. So it's like, I think about the world that we're leaving them economically, you know, and I feel like it's politically for me and my journey politically, because I'm just really coming into this space. My first march to Annapolis was in 2018, you know, so and just learning, like, hey, this space is up here and I can just give them my license and walk in and talk to my local elected officials. You know, that was something that I'm just learning. So the political journey is one that I think that we have to participate in, and learning, like reading things. I believe it was in The Half Has Never Been Told, where it spoke about our ancestors after building a life on these plantations, you know, being ripped from their families and having to walk miles and miles and miles, you know, 2 weeks at a time, you know, just to get to another destination of just nothing. You know, our ancestors walked 20 miles just for town hall meetings. You know, their civic engagement was so important during that time because it meant everything for them to be considered a citizen and to have the rights and liberty of all people. You know, so it's like, hey, I come from people who walk 20 miles during a time when they could be hung. Like, I can definitely get engaged and get involved, especially when you hear of all of the laws that they're passing that disenfranchise us. Voter suppression, gerrymandering, so much stuff that they do to keep us down politically. And because I feel like we have been for so long been disappointed by our government, it's just like the first thing that we, I don't wanna say all, it's just like an overwhelming feeling of disappointment and not knowing what to do. But that hard road is advocating and political engagement. I believe, because I don't think it's no other way.
You know, and you're absolutely right. But I don't know that I think we're doing that. I mean, you have pockets of people here and there, but there's no until Obama came into the presidency, that's when Black people got interested because he was a Black guy. So they got at least interested in politics, and then they start following it more. And whether they did anything or not, at least we became more aware of what was going on. You know, and I know there's a program that I work with, it's called The Initiative, and it's two young Black guys. They have a group of young Black boys, and their whole purpose is to get them civically minded and engaged in the community. That's what their program is about. They meet with the kids a couple of times a month, and, you know, the kids meet the mayor, they meet the city council people, they find out what they do, they find out about the election system, you know. And other than that program, I don't know of a program that specifically introduces young people to civic engagement. And I mean, I'm sure there are some out there, I just don't know of them. Yeah. But we probably
there's definitely more that I think needs to be, because I don't know of too many, and that's something that I would like to definitely get involved with, educating the younger people, and not only educating them on, like, you know, voting, but one thing that I came to learn is, you know, voting is for an exchange. Not only do we gotta vote and not just vote blindly Democratic, like, we have to apply pressure, you know, on our elected officials, and even in how they advocate for us. You know, is nobody really full-throatedly advocating for the Black community. They always like to bunch us and say, you know, Black and brown. It's no more advocating for the brown community, because your constituency, especially if it's all Black, it's like, we gotta, as a group, say, listen, you know, if you're gonna get my vote, this is what you're going to do. It seems like now politicians get in office and say, well, what they can't do. We didn't elect you to say what you can't do. We elected you to do a job. And I think as a group, we gotta start demanding them advocating for us Black Americans. That's the other part while I'm on the Black Americans reparations. Don't go to everybody. Is reparations is to address the damages that our ancestors went through. So basically, if your ancestors, your great-great-grandfather or great-grandmama have no stake in this, the United States, then you don't get reparations. As the Smithsonian reported that Black immigration was to the right of the decimal point in, it was right, like 1940, 1950s. So we didn't get a heavy influx of Black African immigrants until around that time. We had an early influx of Jamaicans the Jamaicans, I believe, in the 1920s. But shy of that, our ancestors been here building it and going through hell. And so in our community, I believe we have to get group specific, meaning Black Americans. I also came into the space because I associated myself with ADOS, which is a young political movement pushing for reparations. Since then, I have separated myself from that. But what drew me to that is that separate identity to say, listen, Black is beautiful, but we have been looking at melanin as it's all the same. And it's not like the history in this country, our ancestors fighting in every war, starting with the Revolutionary War, fighting for our freedom in the Civil War, and then dealing with the disappointment of Reconstruction and everything that followed. If your ancestors didn't go through that, then you don't get reparations.
Do you think average Black people know?
They don't.
Okay. So that's another sort of hurdle to go through to find out.
Yeah.
Because I think the assumption...
I'm sorry, I should have let you finish your statement.
No, I think you probably answered it correctly. I mean, because okay. I don't know, because I think that, I don't know if it was in Chicago, it was some city in Illinois, I think it is, that decided that they were going to impart reparations, but they were doing it based on people who had been in that city at a certain time, a certain year forward. And they had to, and they were doing it, I think it was something with land that they were providing, or it had mm-hmm. more to do with housing and stuff like that, you know, but you had to prove that you and your relatives have been in that city since at least 1930 or whatever the year was, that kind of thing. So, you know, I just wonder
in that instance, that sounds like something local, but like on mm-hmm. the federal level.
Yeah, it was local, right.
Yeah, on the federal level, it's not hard to prove that you trace your ancestry back mm-hmm. to slavery or even after. It's not hard. I do understand that it's a wall people hit in tracing their genealogy. I believe they call it, I think it's 1860. I believe it is. So they basically say if your family member existed in the 1870s, but you didn't see them in the census prior, then 9 times out of 10 it's because of how they kept records of us, which was under kind of like numbers, wasn't like mm-hmm. a name. So, but it's easy to prove. Mm-hmm.
And they have programs like Ancestry.com, which I'm mm-hmm. assuming, you know, because I used to think, you know, sort of going to a place like that was just for your own information. So you would just happen to know and could have some interest or pride in where your family is from and how long it's gone back. But it actually could have some financial repercussions for you, which is really interesting to know. And also mm-hmm. the point you made up about needing more than just something like land, because I've heard that argument many times that in reparations you could not charge Black people income tax anymore, or you could give them a patch mm-hmm. of land and all that. But the idea that cash would be important, and for the reasons you mentioned, that was, I hadn't thought about it in that way before. So I thank you, Constance. I really appreciate you coming and calling in mm-hmm. and talking about this. And we might mm-hmm. have to come back to this and talk about the Black wealth gap and a whole bunch of other things. But
yeah, it's a lot of data. I know when I came in, y'all talking about being sad, but there's a lot of data that we got to be able to swallow and take the, honestly, it has helped me take the emotion out of it, because the numbers don't lie. And it's like, mm-hmm. pull ourselves up by our bootstrap with what? You know, yeah. we have a huge foster care crisis. We have people just working 2-3 jobs and barely making it. And these people, when you say pull yourself by your bootstrap, invest and build and open up your own business, 50% of our population is worth negative zero wealth, negative.
Yeah, I think
so. When I speak out about reparations, I'm speaking for them people who are, it's no way.
We've got some mega churches though. We do give to our churches.
I don't know. I think that's a myth. I don't think nobody's going to church anymore.
Are you kidding?
I do. I think it's a myth.
Wait a minute. That's another whole topic.
Telling you what I think. I
that on another day, Sheila. You know this is a 60-minute program. Anyway, so that's
I'll bring the stats. I'll bring the stats next week.
I have checked out these mega churches, so I know that that's not
true. I want to see.
But we will talk about churches, that.
Why are they not open yet? Why are they not open yet?
Why are you not going to let me close out this program? I'm trying to say goodbye to everybody. All right. I want to thank our guest, Constance Gregory. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Constance.
Really spreading some information. I'd like to have you back.
Don't sleep.
$850,000, fam, per household.
Hello.
Yeah, that's something to
let that just sit on y'all.
That's right.
Put my credit together.
Listen.
So we want to thank the rest of the Old School News crew. We want to thank Sheila Gaskins.
Hey, y'all.
We want to thank Mike Easterling.
Hey, I didn't talk much because I was just so enamored with the information that Miss Gregory brought. Fantastic, ma'am. Thank you.
I had to just let her go because I really, it was a lot of new information and things that I thought I knew something about, but clearly need many more facts. So I appreciate y'all. Oh, no, thank you. And yeah. We wanted to also thank Winston Thomas for being here.
Well, you're welcome.
Yes. See, you even put Mae Winston speechless, and that's something to do. So you got him all quiet and subdued.
You had me quiet. I was listening. I was paying attention for it. Yep.
Yeah.
I will say this. All Blacks should be independent. All Black people should be independent and not party specific. Could be another topic.
Mm-hmm. That's right. What's the name of the book again, Constance?
This is the book by William A. Sandy Darity and A. Kirsten Mullen, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
Okay, we're going to suggest that people check that out.
About reparations.
Right. And check that out so the next time we have this discussion, anybody can call in and we might have be talking about it on a different level. How are we going to get that $850,000? So one more time, thank you everybody for being here. And I really do appreciate it, okay?
Bye,
everybody.
Okay.